Hey, everybody, it's Max. Before we get started this week, I just want to play you a short clip from a podcast that Pat and I were on last week. It's one of my favorite comedy things happening right now called Hello from the Magic Tavern.
Hey, don't turn off the podcast. I know you probably just accidentally left it on, but hey, I'm Arnie. A little over a year ago, I fell through a dimensional portal behind a Burger King into the magical land of Foon. I record a podcast every week and I upload it to the internet. I'm going to say it one more time. Where I record a podcast every week with my buddies, Chunt the Talking Shapeshifter.
Chunt, please.
And Usidore the Wizard.
I am Usidore the Blue Wizard.
And we interview elves and dwarves and dragons. Well, we've actually never had a dragon on.
But this is Dragon On.
And we hang out. Oh, hell.
Sounds terrible. Don't bother.
And we talk about buttholes a lot. I apologize for that. If that sounds interesting, download Hello from the Magic Tavern. And f*** you!
If you enjoyed that, you'll enjoy our show.
Last week, Pat was the guest on the program, and I made an appearance as a Burger King drive-thru attendant. And here's a little clip from that.
Krantz, if I wanted to be your patient, let's do this. Let's do this right now.
Okay.
You look me over maybe and like...
Yeah, I've got a room in back.
Okay.
I would need you to strip to the waist.
Yeah, I'm leaving.
And you can do that from the top or from the bottom. It's really your choice.
Oh.
Yeah. And then,
I'm trying to think. I mean, immediately I was like, I know which one I'm picking. And then I was like, wait, don't rush this. It's not like a which would I enjoy more. It's like, which really would be more embarrassing of the two?
Which would be more helpful?
What is more? What do people usually go with?
That's confidential.
Oh.
I imagine there are all sorts of troubles with your nether regions.
If you want to find Hello from the Magic Tavern, you can check them out at hellofromthemagictavern.com. And now on to our crappy podcast. First question, how did you do on last week's challenge? Were you able to turn any of your Twitter time into like productive reading time?
It depends. Did we have a penalty set up for this challenge?
I would say, well, last time we had some sort of joke that we had to give money to. Was it Scott Walker's presidential campaign?
That was in deadly earnest. That was a real penalty that we were going to pay.
I'm not willing to make a similar gamble over giving money to Donald Trump. So we're going to have to figure something else out.
I will say I've been chained a little bit to Twitter just because of the end of the Kickstarter. So it was kind of, rather than being a passive part of my job, it was a little bit more of an active part of my job. You know, I did actually do more reading, though. I don't know if I directly converted Twitter time,
mm-hmm.
but I did take more time to actually read things that I knew would bring me joy. How about you?
It was a complete abject failure for me for more or less like a similar reason, I think, which was we had a big like product launch this week and all of that. So I was on Twitter like promoting our stupid Trump thing. And I don't know. I just felt it's a fucking hard habit to break. I keep going on Twitter whenever I have a minute.
And we have to take just a moment, right?
Yes.
To talk about you're not stupid, you're brilliant and fabulous Trump thing that you did. I'm assuming people, you know, listening to the podcast already know about that, but I think it bears a little bit of discussion because it was a thing of beauty.
I'll give the quick summary. So basically, I hate talking about my work. I don't know how. I'm actually curious about this because I often like put you on the spot where I'm like, you know, oh, Pat, I'm like thinking about this thing from your book, or I have a question about the story, or it's like, what were we talking about at Tommy when we were drinking in Boston? Like his whole is like, are the events of book two is both like a reliable narrator theory. And yeah. I always feel like authors get put on the spot a lot to sort of say things about their work of like, oh, what's it about? And what's your process? And is this interpretation or that interpretation valid? And I am guilty of that myself, like especially with authors. Like I am constantly asking authors to say something. I'm like, you know, like perform for me, like say something about your work. But when people ask me about my work, I'm like, I don't know, go look at the website. Like I have nothing to say about it. Like it's the joke's not going to be any funnier if I say it out loud. Like just go read it.
You know, I can't speak for authors in general. Although I think in general authors never, again, this is I'm painting with a really broad brush here. I say most authors that I know, which again are most authors that do go to cons and are fairly well socialized and seek out this convention atmosphere, those are the ones that I've gotten to know over the years. Generally speaking, like they at least enjoy, if not love, talking about their books. Me in particular, you know, the sort of writer that I am and the sort of person that I am, I really enjoy talking about the books, and I love talking, you know, people are like, ooh, this scene. And I feel like I should be cool about it. Like they're like, oh, I read the scene and it was so cool. And I feel like I should be like, yeah, man, that was, I'm so glad you liked it, you know, and I should be wearing sunglasses and be like really laid back. But instead, like what I want to do is like, oh yeah, like that was so awesome. That was really the best. And that's kind of not a cool, it doesn't feel cool to me to be excited about your own book, but I am, you know, so I do enjoy those conversations sort of in the same way that I like talking about my kids. You know, I feel proud and I enjoy telling stories about them. Now, on the other hand, World Builders doesn't feel the same to me. It makes me a little uncomfortable because I don't know why. It feels a little self-aggrandizing to talk about my charity work.
I think one reason I do not love talking about my work is I like the effect that the stuff that we do is kind of like a magic trick, in the sense that we do these things that are in actuality they are incredibly complicated. They take a huge team of, you know, 20 people working for several months in advance, doing an insane amount of work to get it ready. But when the user sees it, it's just this very simple, clean presentation, and it's like you click a button and you get the Trump survival kit, right? And the reason that makes me think of a magic trick is there's this great quote from Penn Jillette from Penn & Teller, who's like one of my heroes for my entire life, and he said, the secret to almost every magic trick is that the magician is willing to work a lot harder on some aspect of the trick than any reasonable person would possibly expect.
Yeah.
And that's honestly, that's it. And unfortunately, a lot of times when people ask me sort of like logistical questions, how do you do a successful Kickstarter, or how do you get people to play your game, or I assume you get questions of like, how do I get an agent, or how do I get people to read my book? That really, frankly, that's the answer to a lot of those questions of like, you have to do more work on it than almost any person would reasonably expect. And just every day you got to wake up and be like, my mission today is to get this crazy thing done. And, you know, if all goes well, it seems easy.
Yeah. For me, it's not so much like I can talk about getting an agent. I can talk about, how to get published or stuff like that, or how to work with editors. That's pretty easy for me. But, for me, the magic trick type question is when they say, so how do you bring, you know, how do you create a good character? And I'm like, oh God, it's like, that's not a bite-sized question. That's like, that's sort of like, how do you achieve nirvana? You know, I can't tell you that in 5 minutes or 200 words. It's like, I could attempt to give you some useful tools if we could sit down in a classroom for several hours. But yeah, it's some of those big, what I think of is like deep magic writing questions are great questions, but the reason that they're magic and not science is that, you know, you kind of just do it in a certain way, and sometimes you get what you want and sometimes you don't. Yeah, yeah. So I do know where you're coming from.
Well, anyway, so the Trump thing essentially is we wanted to do some sort of Donald Trump commentary with Cards Against Humanity, but you know, I have sort of an editorial view that we don't want to rehash all the political stuff from last week, but for people who listened to last week's episode, people probably understand. I have an editorial view. Like, I do not think Donald Trump is very funny. I do not want to make hackneyed jokes about, oh, his hair is goofy or whatever. He talked about his dick in a debate or whatever goofy things he does. I actually find him very frightening, and I take him seriously, and I take him at face value, and I'm scared of what I see. So that kind of led us to this our version of doing a Trump joke, which is that you know, we felt like Donald Trump wins this election, it's going to be like the end of the American Republic, and we're going to give people survival gear so that they can survive the like irradiated wasteland that will be left behind and rebuild civilization. So we're sending them a copy of Plato's Republic, seed packets, iodine tablets, a gas mask, all kinds of goofy things like that, as well as our card pack about Donald Trump, which has all sort of jokes about you know, like the sort of like Mad Max style end of civilization.
Yeah, I really loved the stuff that you included in there. It's like, here's flint and steel so you can start a fire. Here's, you know, water purification tablets. And I just saw it. And again, it warmed my heart in a way that so many of your things do, where I'm like, oh, you're singing the song that my soul has been singing, except you're singing it like with that beautiful knife that is satire.
Well, that's the goal, right? Is like, you know, we want to, you know, it's in some ways one of the advantages. Cards is an interesting position. You know, we're not a TV show, right? We don't have to get ratings. We don't need anyone to like us. Like, all we're accountable for is doing things that feel real and honest to us and make us, by which I mean like the eight of us who started the company, that make us laugh and make us feel good about doing. And it's interesting. Like, I feel like we often ask the question, well, what's the thing that Cards Against Humanity can do that nobody else could do? And that's sort of the thought process of the survival bag of like, well, anyone can make stupid jokes of like all the offensive things that Donald Trump has said, but we're the ones who can take it a step further and like do this big sort of elaborate stunt that involves like all this manufacturing and shipping and logistics and stuff. That's sort of using the special tools that we have. Like, it was very interesting. Like, the editorial position that we took on Trump and the sort of satirical point of view that we have, which is that he's really terrifying and that we're preparing for the like fascist regime of Donald Trump and the collapse of civilization that's going to happen, we just stayed in character. So when people wrote us an angry email and they said, how dare you make these jokes, we're like, they are not jokes, and we meant it is only a gesture of respect to glorious leader Donald Trump, and please we just want you to understand that our families had nothing to do with this, and when he comes to power, please put in a good word for us so that we can get a favorable position in the work camp. It's like, you know, and there's, and I'll share one other sort of like behind the scenes story, which is, you know, we always get a deluge of, you know, here's the secret. If people are, who cares? Nobody listens to this. Here's the one secret that we figured out for Cards Against Humanity, which is it's like the whole world is crazy in that when everyone in the world does something, they have like a press release and they're like, in 1 year we are going to release this game or we're going to do this thing, and they get some buzz and people get a little excited, and then they try and do more things, and then leading up to the release they do more things, and then the thing finally comes out and nobody gives a crap. The reaction is like, oh, this thing, I've been hearing about this for a year. And the one secret that Cards has figured out that is reliably extremely successful is we just do things. It's like, we don't pre-announce it. We don't have a lot of ceremony. It's like, you will never hear about anything that we're doing until the day that it happens. And the announcement is always, we did it, and you can click here to buy it right now. And what happens is that takes the period of maximum excitement when people are most interested, which is when they first hear about it, and we seize on that with an action that they can take, which is to get the thing. That is a big reason why Kickstarters are successful, because it's like, people hear about it, they get excited, and they can take the action, which is to back it right away. I don't know why everyone else hasn't figured this out, but the result is, whenever we do anything, we get a ton of media requests. Everyone wants to talk to us, and I got an email request from a local radio station. They wanted me to come on at 8 in the morning, and I am not normally awake at that time, and I didn't want to do a local radio show. So I asked our community manager, Jen, who is a comedic genius and did a lot of the copywriting for this and wrote all of these hilarious emails that I was referring to. And I was like, Jen, would you wake up and do this show? And I even went on the website of the, you know, most, it was an AM radio show. And so I thought, maybe this guy's like a lunatic, like Trump, you know, right-wing Trump supporter. And I went on his website and it was not, it didn't seem bad. It didn't seem like a crazy right-wing, you know, conservative talk show. So I sent Jen on this talk show, and he was a crazy right-wing nut job. And Jen, to her credit, stayed so fucking cool under pressure and stayed in character the whole time and stayed on message. And it's really like one of the most amazing audio clips I've ever heard.
Yeah, can you bring up a piece of it? Because I actually caught wind of that on Twitter, and everyone was gushing about the fact that she like she just owned it,
yes.
and she did it like to the hilt, to the absolute hilt.
No doubt you've heard of Cards Against Humanity. It's a Chicago company, one of the very first big crowdfunding success stories through Kickstarter. Been around for 4 or 5 years now. If you've ever played this game, Cards Against Humanity, it's very, very fun, although very, very dangerous. I know a young lady who loves to put everybody on the spot with this game, and I just pass. You're not allowed to pass, but I pass anyway because it's fraught with danger to answer these questions. Well, they've done a number of successful promotions, including the time they sold 30,000 boxes full of bull waste. And recently, they ran 10,000 Donald Trump survival kits, which I personally feel very offensive. I think it's very offensive because Donald Trump, I'm accepting Donald Trump. Apparently, the folks at Cards Against Humanity are not. Jen Bain is here. She represents the same, and she's a first-time guest here on WDLS. Good morning, Jen. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
So you guys at Cards Against Humanity whipped up 10,000 Donald Trump survival kits. They sold out how quickly?
They sold out in about 2 hours.
Nice. I mean, nice business model. And what was included in a Donald Trump survival kit?
Well, we created the Donald Trump bug out bag to help our fans prepare for the inevitable collapse of civilization when Supreme Leader Trump seizes control of the presidency. So we handpicked everything in the bag to aid in any wasteland post-apocalyptic scenario that may transpire. It's got survival supplies like food rations, seeds for rediscovering agriculture, iodine tablets, a gas mask, a hand crank radio, everything you could possibly need.
And you've made 10,000 of these kits and they sold out immediately. So you're one of these people, I'm guessing, and I don't mean this dismissively, derogatorily, mm-hmm. but you think Donald Trump essentially is Satan coming to rule us all?
Oh, no, not at all. We created this bag as a gesture of respect, and I hope his secret police listening in right now will know that we are extremely loyal and that our loved ones had nothing to do with creating this bag.
Are you prepared for or are you looking forward to the inevitable Twitter onslaught?
Again, this is a gesture of respect, and I just want everyone, all of Trump's loyal followers, to know that we are on the same side.
So why do you hate America? Why don't you want to make it great again, Jen?
Oh, I love America. I'm a very loyal patriot. Please, please, no disrespect.
I think that we would call you a hatriot.
A hatriot?
I've been taught in a talk show host 101 class that if you're not going along, you're part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah, I can definitely see why you support Trump.
Okay, so here's where I learned this. So in politics, what you call this is staying on message, which means when you do an interview, especially if it's a hostile interview and someone wants something out of you, well, basically you have one thing that you're saying, right? That's why people do interviews, is they have something they want to say to the world. It could be something cynical. It could be something that they're trying to sell. It could be something that they earnestly believe, like a good thing, like talking about world builders and trying to get the word out. But regardless, when people talk to the media, they have an agenda. They have a thing they're trying to get out. That is your message. When you do a hostile interview, people are trying to take you off of that message. They're trying to talk about things that aren't your message. And a test of the skill of a person being interviewed is how much they can stay on message. So this is something I learned from James Carville, who was the campaign manager for Bill Clinton's initial presidential campaign. He's an important person in Democratic politics, and he has this great section in his book. It's a little out of date, but it's about staying on message. Think about staying on message as a game. You've been dropped into the middle of a rhetorical maze, and your job is to get back to home base, your message, in as few words as possible. The greatest example we ever saw did not come from a politician or a business tycoon or a skilled academic. It came from a fighter. On November 9th, 1996, Evander Holyfield stunned the boxing world and won the heavyweight championship with an 11th round technical knockout against the heavily favored and seemingly indestructible Mike Tyson. Still dripping with sweat and panting from his exertion, Holyfield was interviewed on pay-per-view. Normally, such interviews are brief and uneventful. The fighter is usually too tired or too inarticulate or both to shed any meaningful light on the bout that he has just completed. But this interview was different. In addition to being a fighter, Evander Holyfield was a man on a mission, and his mission was to deliver a message to the millions of people who all of a sudden wanted to hear from him. Here's how the interview went. Interviewer: "That's one of the biggest surprises in boxing I've ever seen." Holyfield: "Well, you know, I give glory to God, and I want for everybody to know that you can't choose against God. You can choose against me anytime, but when God is involved, Jesus is alive, and he's the credit for it, and I thank God." Interviewer: "Why did you guarantee it with such assurance?" Holyfield: "Because anytime when someone puts God up there, my God is the only true God, and everything must bow to God." Interviewer: "Well, you know, apart from that, apart from religion, because I hope for all of us God is here, I hope he's a just God, but let's get off of that, let's get on to boxing. How did you fight such a brilliant fight?" Holyfield: "Well, you know, I live by the Spirit of God, and like everybody, like I told everybody, whatever the Spirit leads me to do, that's what I would do. And I wasn't nothing so much that I did. Everybody knew that I was washed up, but with God, I'm not washed up," etc., etc. It goes on like that. And Carville says, 15 times in responding to just four questions, Holyfield returned to his basic message. He wanted to tell the world about his relationship with God, and so he told them. Again and again, Holyfield had the presence of mind to slip the reporter's narrow, tactical questions and deliver the message he wanted to deliver.
That's cool. That's super cool.
You would be amazed at an interview where the interviewer has an angle they're working, how effective it is to just keep saying your thing over and over.
You know, that's really interesting for me to hear, because, you know, I've done a ton of interviews, and while sometimes, you know, I do have an agenda, obviously, if I do like a little podcast when the Kickstarter is going on so that I can talk about the Kickstarter, yeah, I'm obviously there to talk about the game. But the vast majority of the time, I'm literally just there to talk. I really have no agenda unless my agenda is to be, you know, informative and entertaining. I know that's kind of my job when somebody is just asking me questions. But even that I don't really consciously think about, because the truth is I kind of like talking, you know. And I don't know if I've ever brought it up in this podcast before, but I have what I've come to think of is my oracular impulse. And by that laugh, I'm guessing I haven't brought it up.
Nope. I don't know. You have to just say what oracular means.
Oracular, there's your word for the day,
everyone.
I mean,
of course, obviously, I just want to say I know what it means, obviously. But just for our listeners, I just want to make sure that you tell them.
See, now I'm backed into a corner. I've got to define my own word. I would probably say oracular is... you know, in relation to or pertaining to an oracle. But what I mean to say is, when somebody asks me a question, a certain part of my brain kicks in. And I've kind of likened it to when someone, like if you have just a tray of metal filings, you know, like iron filings, and you bring out a powerful magnet and you move a magnet over the top of them, they will suddenly all align in a pattern, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had the time that I first became aware of it consciously is when I was a teacher, and one of my friends stopped by my office, and she was obviously just exasperated. And she's like, and she says, "What the fuck is it with guys and redheads?" You know, like, so there's a lot of subtext to her just fucking upset statement. But she goes, "What the fuck is it about guys with redheads?" And but that was in the form of a question, and it hit me, and I said, "Well, you know, red hair cross culturally, you know, even from times before people had international communication, has always been a signifier of magical ability. And I actually, I just vomited forth three coherent theories about what it was about guys and redheads. And I quoted Cicero, and, you know, who said, I think this is Cicero, you know, like we have this from 2000 years ago. He said, all redheads are faithless, you know, except he said it in Latin, which makes it sound way better. And, you know, and she just eventually, I realized she was looking at me like, what the fuck are you doing? And I realized I'd kind of talked for 10 minutes on this subject because she asked me a question and I had three pretty good theories as to what a solid answer would be culturally, historically, you know, and psychologically. You know, it makes sense. I wrote an advice column for about 10 years. I always do Q&A whenever I do an event. So when I do these interviews, to bring it back to what you were saying before, I'm mostly there and I just sort of let that part of my brain take over and I talk about whatever's important to me. And in that respect, I'm probably a really bad interviewee. But
well, you're probably a great interviewee. You're bad at delivering a message. You know, you'd be a bad political candidate.
No, oh, yeah, I think everyone can agree on that.
Do you see Civil War?
I did. I saw it, and you know, and I really did like it. I think it was, you know, and for me. I can be hypercritical is perhaps understating things. I once left a movie with my family. I think this was still back in high school. And we left the movie theater, me and my parents and my sister. And my dad said, so what did you think? And I said, I think it was 5 gallons of shit in a 2-gallon bucket. and he looked at me and he said, he goes, I'd never want to watch a movie with you again. And he was hurt, right? That like, you know, like you've taken family movie night and you've literally shit on it. But you know, other times, like sometimes I remember leaving a theater once and turning to one of the friends I was with and saying like, there was only like 3 or 4 things really wrong with that. and they're like, you didn't like it. I'm like, no, it was super great. But there were only 3 or 4 things really wrong with that. That's how I left the theater with, you know, after Civil War. There's a few things I can quibble about, but I very much enjoyed it.
I maybe this is why the movie. So let me put this is why. That's exactly why I'm interested in the movie, because I look at the movie and, you know, I could not say what's wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with it, actually. It is technically a very proficient movie. Like, it has good plot, good pacing, good characters, like everything is good. It's like solid execution from top to bottom. And yet I watched it and I really didn't feel anything. And I was sort of, I don't know, it was just sort of this like big numb, like punching and explosions. And then I left and I was like, I don't know. I guess that felt like a big deal. That was a lot of fighting. I don't know.
Did, you know, and just to, I'm going to do some follow-up questions here.
Yes.
Have you watched a bunch of the other lead-up Marvel movies?
In preparation to do my homework for this movie, because I knew that it had all the Marvel stuff happening in it, I watched every single Marvel movie that I hadn't seen.
Oh, well.
So I've seen them. I've seen them all. I have not seen the Thor movies, but Thor wasn't in this, so I'm covered there. But I watched all the Captain America movies, and I really like them. I actually think the first Captain America movie was very, very, very good. And I had, there were several scenes that made me feel emotions in the first Captain America movie. And I also rewatched the Iron Man movies, and I thought those were quite good. And I rewatched the Avengers movies, and I felt like the first one was very good, and the second one was even worse than I remembered it being.
Yeah, I'm suspecting I would feel the same way if I went back and watched number 2. You know, and full disclosure, I am a Joss Whedon fan, you know, whatever the far end of the fan spectrum is there.
Acolyte?
Acolyte is probably a more appropriate term. I was trying to, what, it's not aficionado isn't true, fan isn't true. What's farther than fan?
Stalker.
Screaming maniac. Stalker is probably appropriate as well. But I feel like he wasn't given his head there. You could see the Whedon shining through, and you can also see like a bunch of people in a committee kind of passing down edicts in that movie as well.
Well, and the event, like what's so surprising about the first Avengers movie is that it has all this stuff in it. There's all these elements, but in a lot of ways it's a small movie, right? It takes place on a limited number of locations. The story is quite straightforward in that there's one bad guy and you can follow the plot in every instance, and every scene it adheres really closely to that. We might have talked about this on the podcast, but I really like the South Park guys. They have this great writing thing where they're like, when they're writing a scene, they're like, if you describe the scene with this happens and then this happens and then that happens, that's a bad scene. But what you want is to describe a scene with the words therefore and but. This happens, therefore that happens, but that happens, therefore that happens. And if you find yourself saying and then, the scene is fucked. Like it's not a good scene.
It's not dynamic in the same way. That's a really good way of that's a great story. This rule of thumb.
Isn't that interesting? And I felt like the first Avengers, you could tell the story of the movie to someone and every scene would say, this happens, therefore that happens, but that happens, therefore that happens. And with Ultron, I felt like it was similarly, there were, juggling a lot of balls. There was a lot of stuff in the movie, a lot of characters, a lot of plot, but it did not feel like a small movie and it didn't feel like it had a logical progression. It felt like if I described the plot of that movie, you would say, this happens, then that happens, then that happens, then that happens.
Yeah. And I think... I think one of the reasons I love Whedon is I love small story. I'm a huge proponent of small story, and very few people, in my opinion, do small story as well as Joss Whedon. He's got such a great ability to do character focus and to make small moments like really amazing.
What does a small story mean to you? Because it's one of those things for me of I think I know it when I see it, but I don't know how to describe it.
Well, and I was just actually thinking the perfect, like what was one of the best moments of the entire, of the entire first Avengers movie? It was the post-credit scene where they were all eating shawarma.
Yeah.
Now, why the fuck would we like that? We've just seen the Hulk throw someone into fucking outer space. Which did you prefer? Watching the Hulk, throw someone into outer space, or watching a bunch of people sit around and not talk and eat shawarma? You love the shawarma more. Why? Because it's personal and it's emotive. In a way that honestly, it's hard for big action to be personal and emotive. And Joss Whedon is, again, he's shown continual mastery of the ability to pull off small emotive elements of story. And again, that tends to center around character rather than action. He's not afraid of action and can pull it off very well. Like House in the Woods, in my opinion, is a really great example of how action can be put to marvelously good effect. You saw that, right?
Yeah, loved it.
Yeah, brilliant. For me, small story, and ever since I said it on this podcast, when I was all sleep deprived and janked up on caffeine, where I got really riled about something and I said, I'm going to break your heart over a fucking library card. So many people, so many people have echoed that back to me. And I'm like, it's true. Some of the most emotionally intense scenes, it's like in my books are, it's like, oh no, he can't get into the library. And if you try to explain that to someone, they're like, what? Like, this is what this fucking 250,000 word fantasy novel is about, a boy who can't get into a library. And I'm like, and they're like, no, it's not just that. He also plays music once, and it's really, but the music is really good music. And and then he has trouble playing it. And but then he does a good job, even though of the trouble, and then people like it, and it's really good.
There's a lot in there about his shirts.
And then he doesn't have a shirt, but then he has a shirt again. Like, that should be on the back of my book. I want that to be the blurb on the back of the next edition, the 10-year anniversary of Name of the Wind. Once there was a boy who wanted to get into a library, but he couldn't get into the library. But then he played some music instead and had trouble, but then it was okay and everyone liked it. And also then he got an extra shirt at the end.
I don't want to force you to talk about your books every week, but I do, it is interesting now that I'm thinking about maybe one of the reasons I like your writing so much is it's not fair to say that the books are uneventful, but in a lot of ways you like write around the action, right? Like most of the time in the books isn't spent describing climactic action scenes. Most of it is the anticipation of the event or the consequences of the event, thinking, you know, the savoring the tension and the release of the event. And the event is often like anticlimactic in your books, right? You often don't get a clean resolution of like a dramatic action with clean consequences.
Yeah, you've cracked a big piece of the code there. There's sometimes where, again, I can't even claim that I did it intentionally. But I did do it right at the beginning of Name of the Wind, where I deliberately left out, you know, what would have otherwise been the main action scene in the opening chapters where he actually fights the Skrail.
Right.
I can't remember if I said this once before either, but I once had, this was very early on, I think, you know, I was only published for a year, year and a half, and I met a teenager down at Dragon Con, and he goes, you know, my favorite part is like when he fights the Skrail, he's like so badass, you know? He's like, he was in there and he's fighting him and he was just so cool. And I'm like, man, I'm really glad you liked that scene. Except to be fair, you should know that I didn't write it. Like, you kind of did that. And I'm glad that I gave you space in which to have that awesome action scene in your head, but don't give me too much credit for it. Where again, it leads up to that scene and then it cuts away and then you see the aftermath. And again, what you put into that scene is in a lot of ways, it's going to be better than whatever I come up with myself. I also like looking, I think there's not a lot of attention paid in fantasy to the difference between action and drama, which are two different things. I think you can get drama out of a character interaction, but very few people would describe like an argument as an action scene. But for me, like a hot piece of dialogue or a hot piece of dialogue, you know, you know, that's way better. I always shoot for tension. I want tension rather than action. And yeah, I'm all about the anticipation rather than the resolution.
I mean, this is maybe speaking to a big problem that I have with the current sort of generation of these like big budget action movies, which is action is something I'm generally willing to tolerate as a viewer on the path of drama, right? Like, because action has there's interesting things lead up to action and there's interesting consequences. And in the best cases, where action is filmed, what's happening in the action is dramatic in that you're expressing things about the characters. So I would point to the first Avengers film. In the final climactic fight, you actually have these very sweet and funny and earnest character moments in that battle, right? Like, nothing is contingent in that battle. Everything is choreographed to tell you about the characters, the way they're fighting and the ways that they solve problems and the ways that they learn to work together as a group. And I felt like, you know, that was what hooked me as a viewer. It's like, I'm not there to see a sweet them fighting, like, you know, space elves or whatever. I'm there to to, I don't know, I guess to have the dramatic experience, and the movie delivered both at once, and I was happy. And maybe that's one of my criticisms of, you know, Ultron and then Civil War, is that I felt like a lot of that very hyped up, like 20-minute battle between all the heroes in Civil War, I did not feel like I was getting a lot of character. I felt like it was mostly like kind of sweet superhero powers.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting is I left the theater and you know, because I thought about it as well. There's, you know, one of my big, you know, whenever I encounter story and it affects me in one way or the other, I always try to take that down to the foundation and say, why did I feel that way? Why did I like it? Why did I hate it? And if I like it, how can I steal that? And if I hate it, how can I avoid that? And I remember watching King Kong, you know, a movie that I didn't have, wasn't excited or dreading in one way or the other. I knew Jack Black was in it and I like Jack Black and, you know, giant monkey. So, okay, let's do this. But I remember partway through it thinking, oh, Jesus Christ, you know, because, and I remember thinking, you know, if I am ever bored watching a giant ape beat up a dinosaur, that you have fucked up on such a profound level in your storytelling that it's truly unforgivable. Like, I'm watching a giant ape punch a dinosaur and I could give it less of a shit, you know? You know, whereas, like, and so I got done with Civil War and we left the theater. And one of the things that I said was, there was so much action in there and I didn't mind. I said there was so much action in there, but it all felt to a purpose. Like, people were legitimately coming into conflict. Now, again, if I were to quibble the movie, and I can totally quibble it, and, you know, thinking back on it structurally, there are definitely a few issues, you know, that would be more than quibbles for me. You know, like the fact that, well, and maybe we shouldn't spoiler things, but, you know, like how the big action scene resolved, in my opinion, it wasn't horrific, but it was not great storytelling. And honestly, while parts of it were cool, I think what made that big action scene, what tied it all together, and I'm curious what your thought is here, what tied it all together was Spider-Man.
Like, I just felt like that big fight and a lot of the action in that movie was totally joyless, and I was looking at my watch and I was like, I'm sort of interested in the plot and the story and I just want to get back to that. But I did like, I'll say one really good thing about the movie. I'm curious what you thought about this, which is the big hyped up fight scene that's in the trailers and you know it's called Civil War. It's like, you know that the superheroes are going to fight each other. That was not the emotional climax of the movie. That was not the ultimate, you know, confrontation in the movie. And I liked that. I thought that was brave and different and surprising, and it caught me off guard. And the finale of the movie, I thought, was really good. I thought that was one of the parts of the movie that worked extremely well.
And honestly, I think that's the root of the true success of the movie, even if I think a lot of people will walk away from it going, wow, that was some great action, and, well, boy, I'm, you know, that goes to show that they can do a good action movie and people will really enjoy it. And that action made a good movie. But those people are wrong. I think the underlying reason that they enjoyed the movie was the fact that it was emotional and it was about characters coming into conflict. And honestly, I'll go a step further and I'll say it was actually Shakespearean in the respect that there were no villains. You know, Shakespeare was really good. There's no villains. There are, well, with rare exception, right? With Shakespeare, Othello was a villain, yeah. Or rather, Iago. Whereas in Civil War, you had good people wanting the best at cross purposes. And that leads to conflict. And just that conflict is emotional because it's heartbreaking to see two smart people who want to be good, you know, coming into conflict about what it means to be good.
But you know, I want to push you on that because I wanted that so bad, right? Like I conceptually agree, that is what I wanted this movie to be, and I love the idea. I really like the idea of a morally ambiguous like superhero story, which of course superheroes are. Like there's so much moral ambiguity and sort of philosophical problems with like the idea of superheroes as they exist in the Marvel movie, and they touch on some of that in the film, but ultimately, I feel like they betrayed the premise really early on, where there was, they also introduced this element of a big, you know, which is a big trope of the superhero movie, of a big misunderstanding, where actually no one turns out to be right or wrong. Everyone, when all the information stops being withheld from the characters, they actually more or less do set aside their differences and save the day. You know, I hate that trope. It's such a sitcom trope.
It is, and I agree that is, I don't think they nailed it. I think they did pretty good. They did pretty good hitting it. And you know, so here I have three theories, right?
Okay.
About why I might have enjoyed it more than you.
I will say my complaint, thinking back on it, was, wow, I just didn't give a shit about this movie. And in discussing it, I find that I do give a shit about it. So maybe I was wrong. I'm actually like quite worked up about it.
Well, I think one of the things is, I mean, honestly, I went to the movie, you know, a friend said, hey, do you want to go see it? And I'm like, oh, you know, and they're like, it's premiere night. Do you want to go? I can get us a ticket. And I'm like, oh, I thought it had already been out for a couple of weeks, you know, because people had been Civil War talking about it. And I'm like, sure. So I went, like, I had not seen a trailer. I was not geared up for it. And I know personally, you know, low expectations are the key to happiness. So I walked into it kind of hoping for an okay movie, and I got a good movie, so I'm pleased. My guess is you might have gone into it maybe expecting something, you know, maybe great, and what you got is good, and so you feel let down, but I feel happy. The other suspicion I might have is, and again, because we share many of these psychological components between us, if you, like, watched all these movies leading up to watching Civil War, it's sort of like when you have to read a book for class. Like, nobody enjoys the thing that they feel obliged to do as much as you enjoy something that you are looking to do for fun. And my third theory might be, and again, you and I share this thing too, is we both tend to be a little bit iconoclastic.
How dare you? I disagree.
Which is like saying that both of us are a little bit like white and male. We both have, I think, a good piece of iconoclasm in our personalities. And so it feels like you were exposed to a lot more of the hype. And this is going to be great. This is going to be great. And so you might have been a little more resistant walking into it, like I would have been if I had been exposed to that much publicity.
I think those are all very good points, and I actually, like, I don't even really, unless someone, like, posts a tweet about it, like, I don't even have a mechanism to see trailers or ads for movies. Like, I don't know. I usually, like, if people are talking about something, I go see it, and I'm trying not to be, like, crazy about spoilers or whatever. You know, I don't have any of the like self-flagellation of like obsessively avoiding any mentions of anything, but I don't watch movie trailers or anything. Like I love to be surprised. Like a novelty is the thing for me. But another thing that kind of occurred to me about the movie as compared to the prequels, the other Captain America movies. So I'm a very you know, the mice thing. I think you told me about this. The different plot elements.
Refresh me here.
There's the four different kinds of story. M-I-C-E, milieu.
Oh,
something.
Yep.
Character.
I can't take credit for that. That's it's Orson Scott Card's thing. And I think Mary Robinette Kowal brought that up to you because she really gets story structure in a way that I don't.
That's right. And it's milieu and incident, I think, character and event.
Yeah, sounds right.
One of them is, I don't know. Anyway, I'll post a link to this in the show notes, which are available at unattendedconsequences.com. But as a media consumer, I've come to learn about myself that I am very milieu driven. So I like, I'm very sensitive to shitty world building because if I hate when I invest in a world and it does not treat my investment respectfully. But I, on the other hand, I love when I invest in a world and there's a lot to discover there. And so I think like the Harry Potter world is a wonderful, like that milieu wise, like those books work extremely well because, and what I like about it is I can buy into that world and the entire world does not exist for the benefit of the title character, right? There is more to the world of Harry Potter than Harry, and what sells you on that, in my opinion, is that there's all sorts of just like surprising little details in the world that aren't explained away, right? Like Harry encounters all these foods and shops and things, and then later it's like there isn't a fight in that location. It's just milieu. It's just the world. Star Wars is the same way, and I ruined Star Wars for myself as a kid because I got all the like Star Wars encyclopedias, right? Like, I think we've probably talked about this on this show before, but like, you know, one of my favorite lines in the original Star Wars is when Luke is getting ready for the Death Star run, and the general says to him, many Bothans died to bring us these plans. And I like that because it reminds you that even though we're following Luke's story, this is actually a big galactic civil war. The stakes are very high, and there's all this consequence and action off screen that expands the world and makes the stakes larger. And then I got the Star Wars Encyclopedia, and there's an entry in there for Bothans, and they decided sort of in an act of like a retroactive continuity that Bothans were like a race of like mole men who trafficked in secrets, and their job was to steal secret plans for things. And that totally ruined it for me because it took this great milieu of that the world was this big, complicated, full place, and it shrunk it down to just be about Luke Skywalker.
They midichlorianed it.
Exactly. They midichlorianed it.
Yeah.
So I worry that, look, my favorite scene from the first Captain America movie is the scene where he's selling the war bonds, and it's this sort of montage of propaganda shows that he does where he punches Hitler 100 times. I mean, right. That's like one of the best things Marvel has ever filmed. In the second movie, I really like the scenes where him and Scarlett Johansson are just like in street clothes trying to avoid the Hydra people, because that's just a great like spy movie scene, and they're not in costume and there's not fighting. It's just this really tense, the scene where he's in like the Apple store is just like these.
Well, and I have to admit here, I have not seen Winter Soldier. I've heard really good things about it, but that's an interesting data point to everyone out there. Like, I really enjoyed this one. I saw the Iron Mans. The second one was not good. I watched the Avengers. I watched the first Thor, but not the second. But I missed Winter Soldier. And even though that's a fairly big plot point, I really still did enjoy this Civil War.
I don't know. I felt like in a way that the other Iron Man movies did not do, this movie was, granted it was called like Civil War, and I knew that it was the superheroes were battling each other, so I don't know what I expected. But I felt like it shrunk the size of the entire world down to just superhero stuff. And I don't like that. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, in some ways, you know, and here I'm going to do something I don't particularly like to do, which is maybe I shouldn't talk about this.
Whatever it is, now you got to do it.
Yeah, I know. Well, and it's not a big secret, and I hate feeling like I can't talk about things.
This is going to be good.
I'm thinking about this whole movie adaptation, TV adaptation thing. And, you know, it's no secret to anyone who's been on this podcast, who's followed me around on social media for a while. It's like my stories are character centered. You know, if you've, you know, they kind of, a lot of the joy is in these small things. And the joy is in following characters and seeing characters interact in meaningful ways, getting to know them and watching their relationships change, and just the play. You don't just enjoy characters because they change. You enjoy watching characters be themselves in interesting ways. And also there are character arcs, but just, the scene where Quoth and Elladin meet in the rookery, and really kind of start to get to know each other for the first time. It's not good just because one of them is having a character arc. It's good because they are two different characters, each kind of realized fairly well and in a little bit of not conflict, but they don't want the same things. And, movies are not the right place. Or let me say rather, big budget action movies are not the right place to have character-centered stories. Now, again, Joss Whedon pulled it off pretty well for Avengers, but Joss Whedon, that's his wheelhouse, is character-centered stories against a background of apocalypse. Hmm. And even so, a lot of people were critical about, every character got their 15 minutes and there was nothing left for plot in the first Avengers movie. But anyway, I remember leaving the theater thinking, wow, there was a ton of good character interaction in there. The characters as people coming into conflict, experiencing doubt, being themselves, and I went, maybe I'm wrong about how much character you can fit into a single 2-hour movie, because that's been a big concern of mine over the last several months. And then I thought, wait. The big difference is all of these characters not only exist in the cultural consciousness. I mean, you could have never watched a movie or read a comic book in your life, and you still know who Spider-Man is. You still know who Captain America is. You still know, right?
Well, yeah, and also, in the case of maybe not every superhero, but in the case of many of them, I mean, really, how complicated is it? It's like, yeah, I get it. He's an Iron Man.
Right. But the other thing is this is not the first movie in the series. This is, depending on how you count it, somewhere between 3 and 7 in the series. So you've met all of the Avengers in 2 movies. You've met, most of these characters in at least 2 or 3 or 4 other movies. Iron Man has been in 5 movies. Captain America has been in, a bunch of these movies. So that means you don't have to introduce them here. And I think the reason this movie works pretty well is that most of the people showing up, you don't have to waste time establishing characters. You get to establish a few new ones. And honestly, one of the things I super loved, and I want to mention it specifically, I really liked, what is he called? Black Panther?
That's clearly the new spinoff they're setting up.
Yeah, and I love, first off, he's a cool superhero, just pure coolness. I like his style, But as a character, he was a really nice character, and even more importantly, what I truly loved is that, he and his father, so two men, had a really sweet and emotional scene together, which actually involved physical contact. The father touched the son in a loving and tender way. To have that in an action movie was wonderful for me. I think about that a lot because I'm the father of little kids, and I'm trying to make sure that they don't pick up all of this machismo bullshit, we're tough, we never feel sad, be angry, be strong. And to see that moment of genuine sweetness and love between two male characters, especially two characters that are black, right? Because the culture tells us that that's supposed to be a different thing, mm-hmm. according to these cultural stereotypes. I think that was really wonderful. Now, it was not followed up well. And there's my quibble. You know, they didn't give that room to breathe. But the fact that they did it at all, I was proud of them for that. And I think that it worked amazingly well, and it really cemented some elements of his character. He had a wonderful character arc through this movie.
Yeah, I guess you're kind of reminding me of a bunch of stuff that I forgot about that I really did like about the movie. I don't know, maybe I'm kind of changing my opinion on this a little bit. Something else Mary told me once, this kind of reminded me of what you're talking about. She said the difference between fiction and genre fiction is that fiction is people having extraordinary reactions to ordinary events. And genre fiction is people having ordinary reactions to extraordinary events.
Wow, that's interesting. Part of me really wants to argue with that, but that is true in many instances. There is a lot of truth in that statement. I don't know if I would say it's true, but it's truthy.
There's like, and this is what, like, I love this about, like, when I think about, like, Star Trek, right? Like, I love this because you're taking, Star Trek in general does not have a lot of theatrical sort of drama, Shakespearean drama. However, it is talking about the human condition and what it means to be a person in a way that feels very personal to me. And it's an allegory, right? We're taking people and putting them into this showing their humanity in these extraordinary circumstances and these very interesting moral questions that tell us something about our time and age and about the human condition and about ourselves. And that's, to me, that's the best of genre fiction, is like I can watch the first Iron Man movie and I can say, I am not an Iron Man, but I learned something about myself. I learned something about the human condition from watching this movie, which I do. I feel that way. I feel like the first Iron Man is a truly great movie with lots of humor and character moments. I mean, that's like, to me, that's still the high mark of the Marvel films. But I don't know. I guess I'm trying to think through, like, do I still feel that way about on the balance about, you know, these big punchy boy movies?
You know, and I think it'd be interesting. Like, I think if you and I watched Civil War, like if we both watched it a second time, my gut tells me that what would happen is you would like it better and I would like it worse.
It's the curse.
Yeah, it is, because yeah. I'm thinking I'm gonna go in and be like, woohoo, this is cool. And you know, I that first time I went in, I'm like, this is cool, and I'm gonna remember it very rosily. And then I'll come into it a second time and I think my expectations will be very high for it and I'll be disappointed. Right, I wouldn't be surprised if we both yo-yoed, because actually, as I've been talking to you, what you said is, boy, there's a lot of things in here that I like that I'm remembering now. As I talk with you about it, I realize there isn't just one or two things I could quibble. There's more things that as I talk about it, I realize I want to quibble.
Pat, I'm so happy that I could take away your enjoyment of this film. Pat, I'm getting crazy echo. You're gonna put some headphones on.
Oh shit!
What kind of
amateur
fly by night operation is this? It's like
I just plugged in my headphones and it didn't turn off you coming through my speakers.
Hello, West.
I can see your levels coming through, but no sound is coming through. Let's see.
Can you hear me now? Hello, Pat. Hello.
Select.
Hello, Pat. Pat, hello.
Okay.
It was night again. The Waystone Inn lay in silence, and it was a silence of three parts. The most obvious part was a hollow, echoing quiet made by things that were lacking. If there had been a wind, it would have sighed through the trees, set the inn sign creaking on its hooks, and brushed the silence down the road like a trailing autumn leaves.
I can tell. Either you're just talking.
If there had been a crowd, even a handful of men inside the inn, they would have filled the silence with conversation and laughter,
okay.
The clatter and clamor one expects from a drinking house during the dark hours of the night. If there had been music, but no, of course there was no music. In fact, there were none of these things, and so the silence remained. Copyright 2013, Patrick Rothfuss.
Daw.
This will all be edited out.